Hello. hi, it's really wonderful to be here with you all. And again, that was an awesome sharing and perfecto in every way. I am pulling up something on YouTube. I just realized just a few minutes ago, the doorbell rang. And so I had to run upstairs and I received a dozen red roses and a dozen chocolate dipped strawberries. So I hastily put the roses in water. I'll have to go back and trim the stems later, and threw the strawberries in the refrigerator and ran down here. And now I'm getting a song ready. So hold on one second. This is the only song that I can even think of right now. So it must be the song I'm supposed to play. Maybe it has something to do with the roses and the strawberries. I don't know. But the name of the song is, I played it actually in a weekly gathering last month. So, you know, it's not something we haven't heard in a while. But on this Valentine's Day, this song is called An Old Fashioned Love Song.
Just an old-fashioned love song playing on the radio, and wrapped around the music is the sound of someone promising they'll never go.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been with Ron for a lot of years. In fact, Our 27th anniversary is coming up. Not next Monday, but the Monday after, the 26th. And every year I forget that he's going to send me something on Valentine's Day. Isn't that funny? Every year I forget, and every year I'm surprised again. Like, oh, you know. You'd think I would start to remember, but then I guess that wouldn't be as fun, though, if I remembered, would it? So, yeah, just like 5 minutes till the doorbell rang, and I ran up, and like I said, the kitchen's a bit of a mess. There were, I think, a few rose leaves that fell on the middle of the floor and the rubber bands that I cut. And so after this, I'll have to go up and clean up and make it look a little more appreciated for when he arrives. Because you can tell I just kind of threw him in water quickly. But I wanted to be here on time. Yeah. So it's good to be here with you all. And this is the Guiding Light. And we are looking at the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And today we start a new section in that book. The last section that we were just looking at was called Practice. And now this section is called Experience. Okay, I've got your message, Cheryl. This section is called Experience. So this is question number one of the new section. What is the light of consciousness? It is the self-luminous existence consciousness, which reveals to the seer the world of names and forms both inside and outside. The existence of this existence consciousness can be inferred by the objects illuminated by it. It does not become the object of consciousness. Well, actually, just yesterday I was reading something in Rupert Spira, very, very similar, maybe a little easier to understand. I'm often surprised by how intellectual Ramana Maharshi's speaking is. he must have been a very, very smart man. I find even Nisargadatta Maharaj, who is not at all simple, but I find him to be much simpler than Ramana Maharshi. His sentences are shorter and simpler. So I think sometimes in order to understand Ramana, we have to really want to understand Ramana. You know, we have to have the heart to hear him. Otherwise, we could get lost in the very long sentences. But my point is that last night I read something similar in Rupert Spira's The Transparency of Things, which uses a simple model to describe what Ramana Maharshi is talking about. So let me begin by sharing with you from Rupert Spira's The Transparency of Things, and then we'll come back and we'll look at what Ramana is saying, because I think Rupert will help us understand Ramana. I mentioned this briefly at the end of Gentle Healing last night, but I didn't read it. And so now we'll read it. So this is on page 55 of The Transparency of Things. Rupert says, imagine watching a football game on television. The drama is so exciting that all we see are the players, the pitch, the ball, etc. At the end of the game, we turn the television off and we see the screen. At that moment, we realize that we were, in fact, always seeing the screen. But the screen itself appeared to have taken the name and the shape of the players, the pitch, and the ball. The screen is in fact never obscured by the appearance of the game. It is all we ever see. We just fail to notice it. The players seem to obscure the screen, but in fact they do not. Rather, they reveal it. In doing so, they do not reveal something that is hidden. They reveal something, the screen, that is always in plain view, that is always being perceived, but is not noticed. So I'm going to continue reading, but I know when I listen, I hear better when people stop the reading and explain it in their own words. And I suppose that's why I like to do the same thing. Maybe you guys are getting it totally from the reading and you wish I wouldn't stop, but of course, I live by my perception, right? So I love it when people stop and explain what they just read. I hear their explanations better than I do the reading. So I'm going to do that now. So basically what Rupert Spira is saying is that when we're watching TV, and of course he's using a soccer game, which I personally would never become engrossed in. He must become engrossed in soccer games. But when we are watching TV, in my case maybe a movie, I become so engrossed in the movie that the awareness of the screen that I'm watching it on, whether it's a movie screen or a television screen, the awareness that there's even a screen there is completely forgotten, right? Completely forgotten. We recently got a new TV. Ron, I think I mentioned this before. Ron bought a new 55-inch TV, a 4K TV, and he bought a 4K DVD player and a couple of 4K movies. And so when we got it home and we got it plugged in, he put in this 4K movie. And, you know, I mean, I watch TV now. If I watch TV, I watch it from somewhat of a, I don't know, a setback position, probably like I watch life, from somewhat of a setback position. So I don't really get that pulled into it. But maybe it was because the TV was suddenly bigger and we had the sound bar, and the sound bar is making this, you know, bigger sound than we had before. And I didn't notice that I got pulled into the movie. And in the movie, this car goes around a corner and crashes very unexpectedly into another car. And I jumped. I mean, it even surprised me because, like I said, I'm usually not that into a movie. You know, I'm usually watching from a pulled back position. But, you know, the bigger TV and the more dramatic sound when the car went around the corner and hit this other car and crashed, I jumped. And then I laughed. I thought it was so funny that I had gotten so pulled in. But that's what we're talking about, right? We get so pulled into our movie or our football game or whatever it is that we're not at all aware, even though we know, we're not at all aware, we're not noticing that we're watching a screen. But of course, when the movie ends at the theater or when we switch the TV off at home, the screen then becomes extremely apparent, right? The screen is the last thing you might see before you walk out of the theater or walk out of the living room or the family room, just a screen. So that's what he is saying. He's saying that the screen actually was never obscured by the appearance of the game or the appearance of the movie. It was always, always there. We were always looking at a screen. It's just that we forgot to notice it. The screen was never hidden, right? We just forgot to notice the screen. He says the screen is not created by turning off the television. It is revealed by turning off the television. By the same token, it is revealed by it, and by the same token, revealed to have always been present. Right, we remember then that the screen was always there. When we turn the television on again, it becomes obvious that we are seeing the screen and the player simultaneously. So what we have to do is we have to imagine that we're using the TV now to become aware. So we turn the TV off. We'll go ahead and watch soccer with Rupert Spira. We turn the TV off and the soccer game disappears and we're looking at a screen. And now what we do is we decide, I'm going to hold it in my awareness that there's a screen here. And as I hold it in my awareness, I'm going to turn that TV back on. So we turn the TV back on and the soccer game reappears, but now we're purposefully holding in our awareness that there's a screen there. And because we're purposefully holding it in our awareness, we do in fact notice the screen, right? We're not forgetting it. So when we turn the television on again, it becomes obvious that we are seeing the screen and the players simultaneously. The screen is the support and the substance of the players, right? If there wasn't a TV screen there, there would not be a soccer game there, right? The screen is the support and the substance of the players. The screen is not hidden behind the players. While the players are present, the screen and the players are one and the same thing. We cannot separate them. They are identical. We do not need to do anything special in order to understand that we see the screen and the players simultaneously. In fact, once it is obvious, it becomes absurd to think that the screen and the players are separate or different from one another, right? It's actually the light pixels of the screen that make the players appear. So it'd be ridiculous to think that they have nothing to do with one another, that they're completely separate. Having said that, turning off the television is necessary in most cases to draw attention to the presence of the screen, to show that the screen was there first, to show that the players depend on the screen, but the screen does not depend on the players. Now, this is really what he's recommending here without saying it directly, is he's recommending meditation. What he's pointing to is the fact that just like we get engrossed in a game on TV, or just as we get engrossed in a movie, we get engrossed in the images of this world. You know, and if there's a car that goes around the corner, if I'm in a car that goes around the corner and we hit another car, I jump, right? And he's saying in order to see consciousness as the screen this world appears on, we need to be able to kind of turn off the TV, turn off the images. Just like we did a moment ago with with our imagination with the game. We're watching the game with Rupert Spira. We turn it off. We notice the screen. And then we turn it on again, and we choose to stay aware of the screen while we turn it on, and we're able to do so. But what made us aware of the screen in the first place was turning off the TV, right? So he's really recommending that we go into meditation, that we close our eyes, that we go. I like to sometimes even put on sound-canceling headphones, because, of course, I don't do it every day. In fact, most days I don't do it. But, you know, there are certainly noises in the environment. Jamie usually barks 2 or 3 times during an hour meditation. there's the wind, there's the birds, there's the cars going by. So sometimes I like to not only close my eyes, but I like to put on noise-canceling headphones so I also don't hear anything. And that's like turning off the TV, right? We take the images away. We reduce the sense, I don't know what word I want to follow it. We reduce the sense inputs, I guess, as much as possible. And this helps us to become even more aware of awareness. Now, most of us still have the challenge of our thoughts, which also we have to let those thoughts really settle down, or else they just become the new images. We sit there and watch the inner movie, right? But once the thoughts settle down, it's easier to become aware of awareness when all of the senses are kind of temporarily turned off, and the thoughts are temporarily quieted, and we become aware of awareness. So, again, turning off the television is the equivalent. Oh, wait, having said that, turning off the television is necessary, in most cases, to draw attention to the presence of the screen, to show that the screen was there first, to show that the players depend on the screen, but the screen does not depend on the players. So, again, if we use the example of closing the eyes and putting on noise-canceling headphones, we could say that consciousness awareness is there first, and consciousness awareness is necessary for us to see things and hear things. But seeing things and hearing things is not necessary to consciousness awareness. And we can tell that because we can close our eyes, put on our noise-canceling headphones. We cannot see anything. We cannot hear anything. But we still have conscious awareness. So the things that, so seeing and hearing is dependent on conscious awareness. But conscious awareness is not dependent on seeing and hearing. Right? We could permanently lose our sight, permanently lose our hearing, and there would still be conscious awareness. So having said that, turning off the television is necessary in most cases to draw attention to the presence of the screen, to show that the screen was there first, to show that the players depend on the screen, but the screen does not depend on the players. Once this has become clear, we can turn the television back on again and not lose sight of this understanding. And I remember when I was interviewing Ellie Ruzdar, she mentioned this. She said that whenever people meditate, she always recommends closing the eyes. You know, and of course, as we know, Michael Langford does too. Always recommends closing the eyes. She does have a beginning level meditation called an open-eyed meditation, but she says that's only really for beginners. Once you are really aware of what awareness is, then you can close the eyes and pay attention to it. And she says the reason she recommends closing the eyes is because, you know, what the eyes see is distracting, right? And so when you close the eyes, you're taking away at least one sense input, and you're able to pay attention to awareness more easily. And then she says, but after you awaken to yourself as awareness or as consciousness, she says you don't need to close your eyes anymore. You know, you're always aware of awareness. You're always aware of consciousness. You no longer lose sight of it. And so that's what Rupert Spira is saying here. You know, at first, you know, if we use the TV example, you're watching the game, you're not aware of the screen. But then we turn the TV off, we become aware of the screen, and then we turn the TV back on with the intention to remain aware of the screen, and we remain aware of the screen. Well, the same thing is true. If we close the eyes, we focus on awareness. Once awareness becomes prominent enough in our awareness, we can open the eyes again and remain aware of awareness with the eyes open. Because it's always there, just like the screen is always there. So once this has become clear, we can turn the television back on again and not lose sight of this understanding. Once this becomes obvious, we can look at the full spectrum of objects that appear to the witness. We see now that consciousness is not just their support, but their substance. And in the same way that the screen is both the support and the substance of the players. So that's what Rupert Spira had to say. Now let's go back to Ramana Maharshi and look at Ramana's answer. Again, the question was, what is the light of consciousness? And Ramana says, it is the self-luminous existence consciousness. I'm going to stop right there. We're going to dissect his sentence, his very long sentence. He says it's self-luminous. That's the same as saying that consciousness is not dependent on the senses. It's not dependent on, for example, sight and hearing. Just like the TV screen is not dependent on the soccer players. Right? It's self-luminous. Right? Consciousness doesn't need anything. It is there prior to any senses. It is there prior to any experience. Consciousness is self-luminous. Consciousness can be conscious of itself and nothing else. So it is the self-luminous existence consciousness, which reveals to the seer the world of names and forms, both inside and outside. So just like the TV You know, we can turn on the TV and the TV allows us to see a game, right? The TV screen allows us to see a game. Consciousness, the light of consciousness, allows us to see a world. If it wasn't for the light of existence consciousness, there would be no experience whatsoever, which means any experience whatsoever witnesses to the fact that we are existence consciousness. I had a friend say to me yesterday in a text, I chose not to respond to her, but she said to me yesterday, she said, I don't even know that I exist. And it's not the first time she said that to me. I don't even know that I exist. I don't know what to say to that. I don't know what to say to that. If you can see anything, if you can hear anything, if you can think anything, if you can feel anything, that is the witness to the fact that you exist. Existence is the background or the screen that allows all other experiences. It's almost like my friend is like the television screen who has become so engrossed in the game or the movie that's playing on her, so engrossed that she's like the screen saying, I don't even know if I'm here. But the fact that there's something on the TV screen means there is a TV screen. Right? The fact that we experience or perceive anything means that consciousness is present. So Ramana Maharshi says, the light of consciousness is the self-luminous existence consciousness, which reveals to the seer the world of names and forms, both inside and outside. And notice he says both inside and outside. Well, inside, most of us, the loudest form are thoughts. There are also emotions, there are also images, but at least my experience is thoughts themselves are the loudest, the predominant inner form. And I too, at an earlier time, it's funny to me now, you know, when you transcend a certain position to look back at it, it's kind of funny, but when you're in that position, it's not funny. I used to, when I first was beginning to learn awareness, watching awareness meditation, you know, my mind is a very active mind. It now grows silent when I'm meditating, but it used to not at all. And I felt like I couldn't find awareness or I couldn't find consciousness because of the forest of the thoughts. Now, there are so many thoughts that awareness could not be found. But that's actually silly, although I didn't see it then, because it's the awareness that's aware of the noisy thoughts. Without awareness, there couldn't be a noisy mind. Just like without a TV screen, there couldn't be a game on TV, right? So Ramana Maharshi again says that the light of consciousness is the self-luminous existence consciousness, which reveals to the seer the world of names and forms, both inside and outside. It's that basis that allows us to have any experience at all. He continues, the existence of this existence consciousness can be inferred by the objects illuminated by it. Right? So, again, you know, if I see anything, hear anything, feel anything, think anything, that is proof that I exist, or that is proof that I am consciousness. I can infer myself as existence consciousness based on the fact that I experience stuff. The existence of this existence consciousness can be inferred by the objects illuminated by it. It does not become the object of consciousness. So that's that last sentence is why people have so much trouble with things like awareness watching awareness. You know, if you guys are, you know, listening to me, if I'm not talking to myself, if you guys have a moment, I'm going to do a little exercise and you can do it with me. Put your finger in front of your face. You know, my finger's about 8 inches away from my face. I'm just holding up a number one. And look at your finger. If it's blurry, move it out further or closer, whatever works for you. You know, get your finger at a comfortable distance and look at your finger. And you can see your finger, right? Everybody here can see their finger. Now, continue. Keep the eyes on the finger. But just shift your attention a little bit to notice that you see. Now, you're aware that you see, are you not? The fact that you see a finger is proof that you see. You could hide the finger for a moment and look at something else, and you can still see. So the finger is not necessary for seeing, right? But then let's put our finger back and look at our finger again. So you're aware that you see. But notice you can see your finger because it's an object. Notice you can't see seeing. You're aware that you see because you see a finger. The fact that you see a finger proves that you see. But you can't see seeing like you can see a finger. You can be aware that you see, but you can't see seeing. Well, that's what Ramana Maharshi is saying in this last sentence, and you can put your finger down now. That's what Ramana Maharshi is saying in this last sentence. He's saying that you know that existence consciousness is present by the fact that you experience anything in the outer world or the inner world, right? And he said, but you can never see consciousness. If in awareness, watching awareness, if you're closing your eyes and you're looking for a thing as awareness, you don't find it. I get emails every day from people I've never heard of, which proves there are a lot of people that are really listening to Awakening Together's audios that we don't see here in the sanctuary. Every day I get emails from people I've never heard of before who are following along with what we're doing here at Awakening Together. And as a result, they're attempting to practice awareness, watching awareness. And they write to me and they describe what's happening to them and they say, is this it? And invariably, the answer is no, not yet. And so what I try and help them do is to find what awareness is so they know how to rest in awareness, watching awareness. But the reason it's not it is because they're writing to me and they're noticing the sensation in the head. Or they're noticing this wonderful feeling in the heart. Or they're noticing the darkness when you close the eyelids, the darkness. They're still looking at objects. Like we were looking at the finger a moment ago. And in fact, they're looking for an object. They're looking for something that is awareness that I can look at. And I understand that because, you know, the title of the meditation is Awareness Watching Awareness. It's really more awareness being aware of awareness. Remaining with your attention there. Awareness being aware of awareness. Just like you can be aware of seeing. You can't see your seeing. You can only see the things you see. Right? You can see the things you see, but you can't see the seeing itself. Yet you can be aware of the seeing. Just like you can turn on a TV, watch a game for a few minutes, turn off the TV, say, okay, I see the screen here. Okay, now I'm going to turn the TV on again, and I'm going to remain aware of the screen. You can turn the TV on, and you can remain aware of the fact that there's a screen there. You may not be able to see the screen like you could when the TV was turned off, because now you see the game again, right? But you can remain aware of the fact that the game is on a screen. You can remain aware of the fact that you see. And you can be aware of the fact that you are aware. But you'll never be able to find an object to place your attention on that is awareness. Anything that you can place your attention on, sensations in the head, a feeling in the heart, the darkness of when you close your eyes, anything that you can place your attention on is not it. Awareness is what's aware of that thing. So what I do, and I still have a really active mind. I don't know anything. Now I'm giving you guys, what I guess. I think that because my mind is so active, even though I have learned to ignore it, it still chatters a lot. So I think that because my mind is so active, when I close my eyes and when I go into awareness, watching awareness, intention, I'm going to call it. That's where I start, is with the intention. When I go into awareness, watching awareness, intention, invariably the first place my attention goes is the sensations in the head. There's a lot of sensation there because there's a lot of activity there, I guess. And so immediately, that's the first place that my attention goes. I close my eyes with the intention of awareness, watching awareness. And the mind, the attention, goes to the head. So I rest there for a few seconds. I don't push myself because pushing myself feels not correct. Gentleness feels correct to me. So I rest there for a second. I let the attention be on those sensations in the head. And then I ask myself, what is aware of these sensations? Or what sees these sensations? And I become aware of the fact that I am aware of the sensations. Just like a moment ago, we became aware of the fact that we could see the finger. We became aware of seeing through seeing a finger. I become aware of awareness through being aware of sensations in the head. But I know the sensations aren't the awareness. The sensations are just the jumping off point or the bouncing off point. I close my eyes. My attention naturally goes to the head. I don't make that happen. That's just boom where it goes. I let that be for a few moments. And then I ask, what is aware of these sensations? Now, when I ask what is aware of these sensations, I don't find another object. Ooh, that's awareness. I will never find another object. Because the awareness itself is not an object. It's not something that I can see or experience like I see or experience those sensations in the head. And that's the full explanation of Ramana's answer. So let's look at his answer again and notice that we've covered every part of this. The question is, what is the light of consciousness? It is the self-luminous, right? It's not dependent on anything else. It is the self-luminous existence consciousness which reveals to the seer the world of names and forms, both inside and outside. It's what lets you be aware of anything. The existence of this existence consciousness can be inferred by the objects illuminated by it. So the fact that you experience anything infers that you are existence consciousness. It does not become the object of consciousness. You cannot see it like you can see those things, right? The next question, what is knowledge? This is question number two. It is that tranquil state of existence consciousness, which is experienced by the aspirant and which is like the waveless ocean or the motionless ether. I've always loved this answer. I remember, you know, in my early part of the spiritual path, I think somebody told me this and I believed them. I don't think I came up with this idea myself. I think that it was shared with me and then I believed it. And I felt stressed from it as well. I had the idea that knowledge, awakened knowledge, was knowing everything. You know, like when I awakened, I would know everything. I would know what actions I should take, what actions you should take. I would know physics. I would know the secrets of the universe. I would be like Einstein on steroids. You know, that's knowledge, knowing everything. You know, every little detail of the universe, right? Somewhere along the way, and who knows, it might even have been contemplating this very sentence right here. Somewhere along the way, it occurred to me that that's not what is meant by knowledge. Notice what Ramana defines as knowledge. That tranquil state of existence consciousness, which is experienced by the aspirant, and which is like the waveless ocean or the motionless ether. If we were TVs, televisions, we would say knowledge is when we're turned off. Because when we're turned off, we're completely clear about what we are. Oh, I'm a screen, right? Knowledge is when we're turned off. You know, we always think of knowledge as adding all of this stuff to what my brain already holds. But knowledge is when we're turned off and we know what we are. Knowledge is when I know myself as existence consciousness. And I don't imagine myself as anything else. So in effect, it's really not knowing anything. It's knowing one thing, what I am. And that I mentioned before, that when I thought awakened knowledge was like Einstein on steroids, I felt a bit of pressure. There was this, ooh, you know, what if I can't do that? What if I can't know everything? I don't feel as much pressure about knowing nothing except the fact that I'm existence consciousness. I mean, certainly there's still more removing of false ideas that needs to happen. But I can see that. I can sense that. You know, you could say I could smell that. Like it's just around the corner. Knowing nothing but I'm existence consciousness. I don't have to know what I'm to do. I don't have to know what you're to do. I don't have to know physics. I don't have to know the secrets of the universe. I just have to know what I am. The next question, number three, what is bliss? It is the experience of joy or peace in the state of Vijnana, and I'll look this up in a second. Vijnana, in the state of Vijnana, free of all activities and similar to deep sleep. This is also called the state of remaining without concepts. So let me look up this one Hindu, the Sanskrit word first, and then we'll come back and look at the answer. Oh, okay. Vijnana means knowledge, which we just had defined for us, knowledge. So let me read this question and answer again, and I'll use the word knowledge this time. So what is bliss? It is the experience of joy or peace in the state of knowledge, free of all activities and similar to deep sleep. This is also called the state of remaining without concepts. You know, I used to think of bliss as ecstatic. You know, just like running around wide-eyed, ecstatic, laughing at with everything, being just exuberant with joy. And you know, when you look at Ramana Maharshi sitting back on his sofa, and if you look at the pictures of him, often he's not even smiling. He's just sitting there. In fact, he has the appearance of being bored. And it doesn't look like my idea of bliss. This exuberant, overflowing happiness. And he isn't defining it that way. In fact, the way he's defining the word bliss, I would probably use the word completely content. You know, lacking nothing, absolutely whole. He says bliss is the experience of joy or peace. So notice right there, in case you had the idea that bliss meant exuberant joy, notice he's actually calming the joy down a little bit. He says joy or peace. It's a calmed down joy, not an exuberant joy, right? It's kind of a calmed down joy or peace, kind of like contentment, right? It is the experience of joy or peace in the state of knowledge, which means it's the joy or the peace or the contentment you feel when you know yourself as existence consciousness. That knowledge of who you are is the source of bliss. Right? It's that total satisfaction, well-being, invulnerability, joy, peace, contentment that comes from the knowledge of what you are. That is bliss. And it may not be exuberant. It could be very settled down. But it's constant. It is the experience of joy or peace in the state of knowledge, free of all activities and similar to deep sleep. Now, he doesn't mean that the body needs to be activityless. He's really talking about the state of, well, I want to use the word mind, but, you know, it's not really mind as we think of mind. It's the state of awareness. It's the state of presence. It's the state of just being with what is. You know, witnessing without a will, without a need for this to be this way or that to be that way, like a tree or a blade of grass or a mountain, right? They are just present with what is. So it's free of all activities and similar to deep sleep. This is also called the state of remaining without concepts. And again, if I have concepts in my mind, ideas in my mind that I believe, then I can think it should be different. Like today, it's really windy here. I could think it shouldn't be windy, right? Of course, that's a ridiculous thing to think because it is windy, right? But I can think it shouldn't be windy.
And then later, when I go out and take Jamie for her little thing, I don't want to use the W word, but when I take Jamie out for her little thing and it's windy, then I can get upset because it shouldn't be windy. And I can, you know, have some degree of suffering while I'm out there with Jamie. That's not bliss. Bliss is conceptless. Therefore, bliss cannot judge against a concept. Therefore, bliss is always bliss, always content, always happy. And again, it stems from the knowledge of what I am. It stems from the knowledge of truth. So what is bliss? It is the experience of joy or peace in the state of knowledge, free of all activities and similar to deep sleep. Think about that contentment of deep sleep, right? Deep sleep has no concepts in it. Deep sleep doesn't want things to be different than they are. You have to be awake in mind to want the wind to stop. When deep sleep, there's no concepts about wind, right? It is the experience of joy or peace in the state of knowledge, free of all activities and similar to deep sleep. This is also called the state of remaining without concepts. All right, question number 4. What is the state beyond bliss? It is the state of unceasing peace of mind, which is found in the state of absolute quiet, sleep with awareness, which resembles inactive deep sleep. In this state, in spite of the activity of the body and the senses, there is no external awareness. As in the case of a child immersed in sleep who is not conscious of the food given to him by his mother. A yogi who is in this state is inactive even while engaged in activity. This is also called the natural state of absorption in oneself without concepts. So, I can't. Oh, yeah, Cheryl's saying, so this explains why I wanted to sleep when I was depressed. Yes, it does, because then you get to go into contentment. It's exactly why you wanted to sleep when you were depressed. Yeah. I can't say much about number 4. I might be able to bring something next week that says something about it. As you all know, I think it was in November and December, I was reading 2 books by Bernadette Roberts, The Experience of No Self and What is the Self? And in one of those books, I don't remember which one, I'll have to look and find it. In one of those books, she did an incredible job of describing how when we wake up to consciousness, that first awakening is actually a preparation for a second awakening, which is beyond consciousness. Or using the language here, we could say we wake up to bliss. And that state of bliss is a preparation for a second awakening, which is beyond bliss. Right? And she does an incredible job of describing how this first awakening is like a preparation, and what's happening in this first awakening is a kind of a divorce is occurring, a divine divorce. What's happened is, and maybe I am explaining it now, maybe I can, we'll see if I can in 4 minutes. What's happened is, as we fell into the illusion, right, consciousness became focused on the body. And of course believed it is the body and thought it needed the body in order to exist in a world. And so when we're waking up, the reverse of that happens. And it's like a divorce where consciousness is pulling away from the body and away from its belief that it needs the body in order for existence to be in the world. And she talks about how increasingly there's these experiences of ecstatic bliss when, you know, you would not be capable of doing anything because you're lost in bliss. And yet the body keeps doing whatever it's doing. It, you know, if you're cooking dinner for the family, it cooks dinner for the family. If you're, you know, walking down the street, it walks down the street. And she talks about how what you learn through this process is that existence can move the body in the world without the necessity of an I. Without the necessity of what appears to be a pilot at the helm. And when this lesson is fully learned, then the sense of self is able to completely die. And she describes this experience of moving beyond consciousness, which is beyond bliss, which has nothing to do with the senses, and maybe I will need to bring her book to finish it, but the body continues to operate normally once this divorce has occurred. So this is what Ramana Maharshi is also talking about here, right? It's like a divorce between consciousness and the body, or we could call it a detachment. It's no longer believed there has to be an I at the helm to make the body talk, walk, work, right? The body's going to talk, walk, work because of interdependent co-arising. And consciousness can return to itself, divorced from the body, because it doesn't need to be the driver anymore. And I am not the body, I'm the divorced consciousness. I'm the consciousness that has removed myself from believing I need to drive the body. I am the consciousness removed from the body. So let me read his answer one more time. And then if I can find her discussion on this, I might come back to this next week. But the question is, what is the state beyond bliss? It is the state of unceasing peace of mind, which is found in the state of absolute quiet, which resembles inactive deep sleep. In this state, in spite of the activity of the body and the senses, there is no external awareness. And he gives the example of a child who takes food while he's asleep and he's not aware of it. Imagine a sleeping child nursing off of the mother, right? The child is not really aware that it's nursing, even though it's suckling, right? In this state, in spite of the activity of the body and the senses, there is no external awareness, as in the case of a child immersed in sleep who is not conscious of the food given to him by his mother. A yogi who is in this state is inactive even while engaged in activity. This is also called natural state of absorption in oneself without concepts. And I will stop there, and we'll return to that question if I can find the right passages from Bernadette's book. All right? Bye, everyone.